Welcome to this episode of The Cyber Show with our very special guest, Danny Jenkins.
So Danny is the CEO and co-founder of ThreatLocker. And ThreatLocker is a leader in cybersecurity solutions, constantly working to achieve a positive security model with a diverse range of systems and interoperability. I just attended ZTW 2025 with you, Danny, in Orlando. We saw you on stage loads of times, just absolutely thrilling every time you were up. You were a great speaker. And we caught up with you while you were dressed as Iron Man, which was just one of the most amazing suits I've ever seen in my life, which I believe was donated to charity the money from. So that was amazing. We've also spoke to Seamus last year about what you do at ThreatLocker. And it seemed to us immediately that ThreatLocker is exactly what is needed. And we just wanted to get to know one of the founders and the theory behind it. So welcome to the show, Danny.
Thank you for inviting me today.
Danny, your background is that you were a bit of an ethical hacker before starting up with ThreatLocker. I'm wondering, how long were you into that? Was that something you did here while you were in the UK?
Kind of, I guess. I left the UK when I was 19, so 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. I started my IT career in the UK, but I suppose I was very short as a kid and I had a tough time at school. So my revenge was back in Windows 3.1 days, writing batch files to delete people's homework that I didn't like. But I suppose that's the only unethical part of it, if you like. And then I just really got into computers, and I didn't really start doing formal ethical hacking until after I sold an email security company. So 2014, I think, or 13. And I did it for a few years, and it mostly ended up turning into me getting called to help with ransomware recoveries.
So what's your route into cybersecurity? Was it self-taught? Did you do it through research? Did you go to school? Or was it certification based?
So I left school at 15 in the UK, and I got a job in IT as an apprentice IT. I didn't really get into security, and security really wasn't a thing back then either. I suppose until about 2002. And what happened is I was working at a corporation in Ireland, and it was a big multinational called Kingspan, and they make building materials, and they acquired a lot of companies. And they didn't have an IT department at their corporate headquarters. And I was working at one of the divisions, and they called me up because they kept having issues. And then they suddenly started getting malware that spread across their entire global network. Wow. So I was kind of very young at the time, but I was the only IT guy that was in the corporate headquarters. So it almost became my responsibility to, how do we secure a global network when every single division is autonomous? And of course, ransomware didn't exist then. It was viruses that said, I love you, and things like that. But it was became a corporate issue. So that's really where I started in security, was how do I secure 146 different sites without actually being in charge of them?
It's great to kind of be thrown in the deep end like that. And, you know, we've heard that story again and again from people that, you know, cybersecurity didn't really exist when I started. And it's like that the industry has formed around what we already are and all of our various life experiences and practices. And we've kind of found ourselves thrown into the world in a sort of Jean-Paul Sartre kind of way. And that's really exciting because, you know, it's not like you went into a decided you were going to be into accountancy instead of being a line tamer or something. Let's kind of take that a bit further and see, you know, from that experience of ethical hacking, what was a sort of genesis for building a company that's based on a positive trust model? And in that sense, what does ethical mean here? And what I'm getting at, just to give it some context, is now we had a Martin Smith the other day. You know, his genesis story was he got conned. You know, he was a victim of a fraud. And we've heard from many people in cybersecurity that there was kind of something that just, you know, that tipped them. And they're just like, that's not okay. I'm going to do something about that. I think I've heard you talk about that a little bit before. Have you got a story there, Danny?
Yeah. So essentially what happened was, so I told this small email security company, and we decided that I wanted to do ethical hacking. I started off charging companies to go in and see their weaknesses. That didn't work so well. So I started making a different deal in that I'd say, rather than me charge you to see your weaknesses, you sign an engagement and I only get paid if I get in. And that meant if I couldn't get in, I didn't get paid. And I always took a different approach. So most hackers are looking at hacking books or going to hacking websites and using hacking scripts. I always thought about it from if we understand the IT systems, we understand human behavior, we can manipulate those systems and manipulate humans into doing things on the systems. Mm-hmm. And I could write custom malware that would never get detected. And so I started off doing that. And what happened was very, very quickly, my name got around as a security expert. So companies started getting hit by ransomware. And I wanted to start another business, but I really didn't want to work in sell to IT people again. I wanted to work in technology, but I'd done 10 years of selling to IT people, and I'm an IT person, and I'm busy all the time, and I forget to show up on calls. So I said I didn't want to get into, I wanted to do something in healthcare tech or something like that. But I got this call, and there was two cases, but the first, probably the most impactful one, was it was an IT company in Australia called me and said, hey, can you help with the ransomware recovery? And I got on, and they'd paid the ransom. All their data was gone. They paid like 22,000. They didn't get their data back when they paid the ransom. And the owner of the company calls me a week later, and I'm trying to recover it. So I'm doing everything. I'm using OnTrack data recovery to do low-level disk recovery. I'm restoring Exchange files from OST files. All options are gone now, and the SQL Server was dead. Everything was gone. So We're covering all these files, and the owner, who's a 60-something-year-old man, calls me, and he's coming up to retirement. And it's a 50-year, it's a broker, I guess, a 50-user company. And he starts crying on the phone. But when men start crying on the phone, and I'm like, oh, crap, what am I going to do? And he's like, is my business gone? And I couldn't tell him no. And he survived. We got through it. That was the first point. And when I said to him afterwards, when we got it up and running, and it was painful for him, so what can I do? And I said, just block everything. Just block all untrusted software. Block, only allow what you need. It was not block everything, but just allow what you need. And his IT company told him I was smoking crack. And it was impossible. And I think that was the first point. And it kind of started niggling with me at that point that I need to do something and build this so it's viable. The problem was the cost of building this was going to be so great, I could never make money because people weren't buying it. Mm-hmm. And it was only 2017 when WannaCry came. At this point, I'd written a concept of the software. We had it working and functional, but it wasn't smooth. Mm-hmm. And in 2017, when WannaCry came out, that's when it changed, because I was like, it just blocks it. And I was like, we've got to forget that enough people aren't buying this. We've got to make the whole world realize this is the way to secure your environment. And that's when it just went off. I was like, okay, I'm giving up everything. And, you know, I gave up, stopped working, stopped earning income. I got into credit card debt. I was like, this is happening, and we're going to change the world, and we're going to change the way that people think about security. The way I think about security is we have to stop thinking about what do I need to prevent, and we have to start thinking about how do I make my system more secure. But I think of about hacks that haunt me and things that haunted me in time. This hack didn't haunt me. It was very easily done. It was very obvious how it happened. It was awkward because there was someone upset. Mm-hmm. I think that when I think about stuff I've seen, I think the first time I saw a rubber ducky hacking device, what my problem was is I thought as an IT professional, as a security professional, that rubber ducky, that USB devices are drives. So if you plug them in and you don't have auto run enabled, you can't get infected. And so I think, while conceptually I think, well, that's so simple, that really scared me in that was a big wake-up moment in that what you don't know will hurt you.
Absolutely.
And the first time I saw that, and we have a new one here that a demonstration we made, we'll show in Zero Trust World next year, where you plug it in. And I won't give any vendor names, but I went to one of our investors who's using actually one of our competitions, big corporation. And I asked them to plug it in. I told him what it was going to do. And he had one of the biggest EDR providers out there, and he plugged it in, and it took screenshots of his machine every minute and just emailed them to me. I showed him, and we unplugged it and we killed it. But it was very, but that scared me because I didn't know about it. And if you don't know about something, then you realize, what else don't I know? I think the other thing that what keeps me up at night is things like SolarWinds Orion.
Mm.
Because of course that affects me personally more if it was to happen to me. But I think, well, one is I could be running a piece of software. How does that not eat my data? But other thing is, we have so many controls, so scared that someone in Russia is going to try and get into ThreatLocker source code.
Mm.
That keeps me up at night.
We raised that in another forum, I think. We were talking about supply chain attacks, probably with Seamus. I think we were saying, you know, how do you know that you know, you haven't been owned, and therefore all of your clients are? And you know, he was kind of quite adamant about good into compartmentalization and isolation. But yeah, these kind of class type threats that can migrate horizontally very, very quickly are absolutely terrifying, because you know, you can just wake up tomorrow and find out your entire ecosystem's been owned, and that's bad. But now, when Helen and I looked at you know, in our systems theory stuff, at enumerating badness, this idea that what you don't know can hurt you, there's no end to that anxiety and that bottomless pit. And so you know, let's emphasize this turnaround that you've made to a positive security model, or the trendy word, sort of zero trust approach, which is to ring fence in what you allow and the scope of your of what you really care about, because you might not know about these other things outside of it, but you've put them outside of your scope, so you don't have to worry so much. Would you like to elaborate on that a little bit, Danny?
If you're thinking about, well, how could I get attacked tomorrow? If I'm an IT guy managing a hospital, how do I get attacked? There's two ways you're getting attacked. One is somebody runs an application or exploits an application on your machine. So what that means is someone, it could be as simple as a user being called by someone saying, hey, I'm calling from the IT department, can you run Go to Assist? And they can use voice AI and trick you. You've got 1,000 employees, people are vulnerable, someone's going to do something silly. Could be someone downloads a piece of malware and it creates a foothold on your network and someone moves around inside. But a piece of software, whether it's downloaded or there's a backdoor or misused in your environment. The other way is that you've got an open port. So there's a port open on your firewall, you've got a VPN server, you opened up RDP, you've used Nadia Web, you've got Citrix, there's an exchange vulnerability. They're the two ways that someone's going to get into your environment. And so when we think about how do I protect a network, there's lots of things you should be doing, but the first thing you should be doing is saying, well, what software do I use on my network? And what do I, and everything else is irrelevant. This is what we should continue to allow to run. We use Office, we use Teams, we use Zoom, we use Sage, whatever it may be. I'm going to let this run and nothing else can run. So when you do that, you stop ransomware running, you stop malware running, you stop people downloading remote access tools that aren't necessarily even malware but can be used. I saw somebody use Veeam backup to exfil data by literally taking a backup of their system. The EDR didn't even flag it because it's normal for Veeam to think it. And but you block all of that. Our clone is another one we see. So the second thing you do is you say, well, all of the software I do trust, I'm going to take away that word trust. And I hate the word zero trust, by the way, even though we use it in all of our marketing, we have zero trust world. But it's not technically accurate, because what it means is less trust, or trust you need, only what you need. But we're going to say, I trust Office, but what do I trust Office for? I trust Office to open my Word documents. I trust Office to go to my Office 365 tenant. I don't trust Office to call PowerShell. So we come up with this concept of ring fencing, where we say, we're not saying I trust this application or I don't trust this application. It's about, what do I need to trust it for? Zoom needs to see my face. It needs to hear my audio. But it doesn't need to see PowerShell. It doesn't need to see my files. So if there's a bug or a vulnerability or a backdoor built into Zoom tomorrow, the amount of damage it can do is pretty high, because you can see my face and it can see my audio. But it's a lot less than seeing my entire network. And that's really the concept of ThreatLocker. We do it at a network level, we do it at an application level. It's like, how do I give you what you need so your users can do what they need and no more?
So let's talk about resilience. So despite the ever-rising number of attacks year on year, we still talk, in most companies, like a cyber attack could take place, or it might take place, but actually they are taking place all the time. But you've got teams and defences, often working in perimeter type defences, who will, you know, keep those incursions out most of the time. But should companies start adopting a different attitude? Because they're not always going to be successful. We see that every single day in the news. We as engineers know that's the case anyway. But really, we need to adopt this when, not if attitude to cybersecurity, to start preparing for the inevitable. And I feel that's what you were sort of aiming at there, is that resilience, that when they get in, if they get in, if there's a vulnerability, it's not going to do as much damage, because it's been restricted from the access that would allow that damage to happen.
And I think that's it. So I think in technically nearly every company that has any number of employees in it occurs some kind of breach of some description.
Right.
And it could be as simple as someone got into someone's email, someone's phone was left and they read their email. Mm-hmm. It happens. And they're micro incidents, they're not significant mm-hmm. In most cases. If we look at how many companies, so we asked like a few hundred companies, you know, what cyber attacks have you had? Probably somewhere between 10 and 15% of companies have occurred a major cyber incident in the last 5 years, where they've had a ransomware attack, their systems were down, they had to either pay a ransom or restore from backups, their data was stolen. And we're not talking about one account here, we're talking about the whole network. So that's not a small number, 10 to 15%. If I said you're going to crash, 10 to 15% of people are going to wreck their car and be seriously injured in the next 3-5 years, that's a pretty bad number.
Right.
The reality is how bad these things often are, well, if they even happen, depends on your security posture, not your ability to respond to it. Right. Your ability to respond is the exception. So when you make a mistake. So I have a burglar alarm in my house, and the burglar alarm is relevant only when my lock fails, or I don't lock my door, one or the other. I forget to lock my door, or my lock fails to provide the security it's supposed to. But the first thing I do is lock my door. And when we think about response, we should be thinking about, well, the first we should be saying, don't let them in. Secondly, we should be saying, don't let it run, don't let it do more. If it is allowed to do something, limit it. And it comes back to that contextual. I trust the person that runs my finance department not to steal $1 million from my bank account. And that person has to wire $1 million regularly. I do not trust them not to accidentally enable macros on a Word document and have someone else connect to their machine and steal their data. And I think that's I'm giving the controls to that person that they need to perform their job. And the damage that can be caused if someone does do something, even if someone left their laptop and someone managed to log in, we have so many controls in place. They can't do more than they need to. So the damage is limited to that.
And you emphasize as well that fast response as a mitigation tool against ransomware. A lot of people will say that the quicker you respond, the better. But how do you build systems that bounce back quickly like bamboo instead of standing strong like an oak?
So one is not getting the ransomware attack to be as big. So if someone gets into your office today, you've got your hospital, and you've got 2,000 computers, and someone pushes out a group policy to deploy ransomware to 2,000 computers, which I've seen happen hundreds of times. You may have rehearsed your recovery, and you should do this, of your servers, your Exchange servers, your Active Directory servers. You may have said, I'm restoring all of this. I can, in my perfect environment, in my lab, I can restore in 6 hours. Mm-hmm. And you say, great. So, and I've got offsite backups, they're disconnected, I'm up running. You get a ransomware attack that comes in and kills your Active Directory servers, kills your Exchange servers, you're gonna recover pretty quickly if you've rehearsed that. Now, your data exfil, that's another problem. Mm-hmm. It pushes the GPO out to 2,000 laptops. You've got doctors, you've got users, you've got people on remote sites, you've got a limited number of hands and eyes. Even if you have the best imaging process in the world, that's a slow recovery. So I don't think there's many companies that can sustain a massive attack without having large downtime. When you see these companies recover fast, it's normally because the attacker didn't get onto every endpoint. Because even if you got onto every endpoint, and every IT guy knows, I go and give Sally or Bob a new laptop, and I've installed all their software, everything's working fine, I'm going to have 6 or 7 support tickets from Sally or Bob over the next 2 days, because she can't log into her G Suite account because it used to save the password and that saved password's gone from her browser. Or her printer's not working because it wasn't set as the default. Mm-hmm. And you go and check that box, you go and multiply that by 2,000. That's the difference when you see one company recovered faster than another. Now there's bad companies and there's good companies, but when you're looking at the difference between they got up and running in a day versus 9 months, it's normally about how much damage was done. So you should be focusing on making sure that if damage can be done, and damage can always be done, how big is it? And keep it as small as possible.
Is it a cascading damage? Because I think that often in systems, once you've crossed a certain threshold, once you've done something and that the dominoes have started to fall, it's all over. So it's all about staying what we call left of bang. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
We call it boom here, but left of boom, okay. Right of boom.
Cool. You know, it's staying on, if you can just stay on that side, because once you've crossed that threshold, you've got this cascading failure and all sorts of bad stuff happening. And they're absolutely right. It's multiplied by the scale of the organization. So, if you know, and to the square effect. So, you know, for 10 gives you 100.
We get so many customers come to ThreatLocker after they've been hit by ransomware saying, hey, we need to lock down our systems. And we'll often send, you know, when CrowdStrike blue screened half the world last year, we sent our staff out to local school systems to help get the schools up and running because they didn't have the people. And even though they weren't ThreatLocker customers, we just did it because we want our schools running. but having people on the ground and having people who don't break is one of the key. If you do get right of boom, and you never want to get right of boom, do everything you can to stay left of boom. Mm-hmm. And that means one of the challenges as an IT professional is IT people have lots of friends.
I like this. Let's just expand that a moment, Danny, because yesterday, a couple of days ago, you know, we were talking to the SASIG about the importance of community, of friends, of people to reach out to. And I love your concept of your cyber heroes and almost like federal emergency management. You know, you've got an aid team that you can parachute in. People must be very, very reassured and glad to know that kind of capability is out there, right?
Yes, but I think when the world ends, it gets a lot more difficult. And we made a decision. So we don't charge for professional services as a company at all. So if we help all customers, regardless to whether they were secured or not secured, deployed properly or not deployed properly, we offer support. That's our priority. Our second priority is community. How do we help this community? And sometimes that literally means having talking about rubber duckies, they're great hacking tools, but they're also really, really good tools for automating rebooting into safe mode and deleting files that stop a blue screen. When so that was really useful in the case of recovery. So we'll send those people out. But I think having that community, but also using your own team, people often, like I've seen so many companies I've gone into, they've got 2,000 laptops they have to re-image, and the IT team has 5 people. There's normally, in 2,000 laptops, there's normally another 20 people who can install Windows in that organization, and you can just pull them in. Like, go and get the sales guys who know how to install Windows to help.
Yeah.
But again, get left to boom. If you don't get hacked is the key.
So in an organizational model, there's internal and external security point of views. Gatekeepers will manage the external face and policy manage the internal. Whichever side of the wall you're on, trust requires effort and energy. Someone has to monitor trust, sense trust, and build trust, judge trust. So who pays? Who executes? Who takes the strain of establishing and maintaining trust values?
The policy is a piece of paper. It's written by internal people or business people that have said you're not allowed to do this. You have a policy that says you're not allowed to work overtime, which would be a crazy policy in Florida. But you can have those written policies. Tangible controls are internal to the business as well. And they're quite often implemented by technology people. Mm-hmm. And that is the actual thing that makes the policy real. Because we have a policy that you can't drink more than 2 drinks at a trade show if you're a ThreatLocker staff, or a drink every 90 minutes. By the way, that policy gets broken. What stops it getting broken is if it gets broken significantly, we can't physically stop them drinking, but we write them up and they're punished. Doesn't work the same with ransomware, because if someone gets hit by ransomware, you can't write someone up and punish them, it's too late. But I think it becomes the first thing you should do as a company is decide who needs access to what and what is their job. The second thing is you should use the technology at your hands to make it so the maximum controls are implemented. And we start off with the biggest wins, because first of all, you could do this all day long and you could not be perfect, but you say things like, I'll block untrusted software, I'll take away admin rights, I'll grant file access where file access is required. They're big wins, very easy to do. Mm-hmm. The second thing you can do is you can now start implementing monitoring tools. Mm-hmm. And I think the person who monitors it should be the managers of the company, and the person who implements should be technology. And you can say things like, for example, we have a tool that says my CFO can upload files to the internet because he needs financial files. Mm-hmm. But if he uploads more than, I can't remember the number, let's say 50 in an hour, we automatically shut that ability away, because that's the automatic reply to something outside of the normal. So I think it's a combination of technology versus, and whoever implements technology and business, and monitors should be the business owners. And I don't mean the people who own the company, but I mean the people who own that process in the business.
So we want to move a little bit more away from those sort of silos that businesses are currently in, where you'll have your techie team often in the basement and you'll have your executive teams on the other side of the building miles away. And they don't really interact with one another too often or engage with each other. And actually, what we're seeing is there's a push for cybersecurity to, and IT actually, to move much more up the building into that executive layer so that they can work together more cooperatively.
I'm a techie person, and I have a team of technical people that are assigned to me because I need business things. So I'll often ask them to research things or have a look at things. Now, we're a technology company, so that's not. But it's, if you as a business use technology, you can actually be better as a business. You can help efficiencies and have technical people embedded into the process, just like you do financial people embedded into every department. You should have IT embedded into it. And I use the word IT. It seems as though IT has taken the responsibility to security. In the perfect world, they don't, but they also execute so much of it. Mm-hmm. But you should have someone with technical security, IT, embedded in your process, and you should tell them what you need, and they should be telling you how you can limit that to the least amount of privilege possible. And if you get good technical people, if you get good security people, they don't slow down the business, they bring it forward.
What is the relation between identity and trust? So how do we know who to keep trusting and what happens when they change?
Again, it comes down to, it's not really about trust and not trust, full stop. It's about requirement to do a function. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, we had $50,000 stolen from our bank account by one of our financial people. They had access to the data. I mean, it happens. Like I think it's got nothing to do with, do I trust this person? There's two requirements. Give them access to the data, to the applications, to the systems that they need access to. And if they don't need access, don't give them access. And the second thing is, and have a system to monitor that access for anomalies or certain excessive use. So, and people change. And if something comes up and someone changes, you can monitor for certain behaviors that might cause change. So in our finance department now, we implement regular credit checks to see if someone got into a hole. Does it mean someone's not going to steal from us? Probably not. That's the same principle. You decide what risk you're willing to take in your business with a certain aspect. So we decide up to this amount of money, we think it's cheaper for us to take the risk and lose it so often. Over that, it's not. For this group of users, they need to run a certain amount of software that is considered IT tools and could be used by hackers. But for the rest of the group of users, we don't. Just give them what they need. If someone becomes a bad person tomorrow, they're going to become a bad person. If they only have access to their customers' data and they're in sales, then the damage they can do to your company is their customers' data.
I think you're always on the losing side there, where you try to pin down identity. It's much, much more mature to look at behavior and then to be very reactive to bad behavior. So I don't know about
bad behavior, though. That's the word that's difficult.
Okay.
Yeah, because and intent of behavior. And I think identity plays an important part with behavior. Limitations, and it's not normal for a salesperson to upload financials to the internet.
Yeah.
It is normal for the CFO to send financials to investors. So I think identity is really important, but cross-reference with behavior. And I also don't think there's a good or bad behavior. If you take a piece of backup software that takes all your files and uploads them to the internet, is that good or bad behavior? It depends if it's your backup software. But if it's a piece, so I think what you have to cross-reference, and I know the word identity often refers to person, but it doesn't have to be person. You have to
cross-reference. It could be role, yeah.
Well, it could be role, but it could also be technology or software, or it could be an application. So knowing what, maybe it's not identity, what, who, and you're looking is the object, the source of the object, and what it did is really important. So I think it's absolutely a good point. You have to look at behavior, but you can't just look at identity and you can't just look at behavior.
You also brought up another really good word there, Danny, which was intent. And that there's a huge rabbit hole to go down. Probably not today, but the idea of second guessing intent or proscribing intent and so on is also part of that. Yeah.
It's a problem with AI, and that's this is the challenge. I mean, AI has become a huge dirty word, but if you're trying to detect bad software, for example, there's two ways you're doing it. You're looking at a bad list, or you're looking at what it does bad. So if the software is taking your files and uploading them to the internet, or that's potentially bad software, but it could also be good software if it's backup software. So, and also, I mean, we see the same. I onboarded a customer who had 5 remote access tools on their computers, and they only knew about one of them.
Whoa.
And they were all good tools. I use the word good tools. Weren't all good tools. Some of them I'd never installed, but the vendor wrote them with good intent, but they're all being used with bad intent. Computers can't decide that. AI can't decide that.
There's a platonic question about kitchen knives in there that we can explore another day.
There, yeah. I mean, same scenario.
And do you know what? It's really interesting because AI did really take the tech world, particularly the cybersecurity world, by quite a shock. So I remember only, 4 years ago, I had a really heated debate with a very experienced security architect. And he was saying that there's going to be absolutely no AI whatsoever in our workplaces, that it won't impact cybersecurity at all. And we're 4 years later, and he's got co-pilots, and he's dealing with ChatGPT, and it's become really, really something that he's dealing with a lot of his time. So what has really changed for you guys over the last 8 years? What have you seen? How much has that grown and become a problem?
So I think we have to separate the conversation of AI and generative AI.
Right.
Because, of course, everyone's talking about generative AI, and what is more impressive, that in 2016, I had a car that could determine the difference between a trash can and another car and relatively well steer down the world. It was bad by today's standard, but I could take my hand off the wheel. I could pray for 30 seconds and I could get through. And it was pretty smart versus today, where something can generate a document that has no substance and no value in many cases. And people are massively impressed by ChatGPT because it looks and sounds human. But it's more impressive in my mind from a technology point of view that a camera can determine if something is a face and whose that face is. And we've been using machine learning, and I use that term as well very carefully, not because people often refer to machine learning as certain components in PHP, but machine learning in that we learn from data sets that come across multiple customers on how applications behave since day one. Has our business changed with the introduction of generative AI? Absolutely. It's getting harder and harder to detect malware. So that's a good thing for us because we don't rely on detection technologies. But also we use it. We use it to create reports. We use it to create analysis. We use it to understand what's wrong with our code.
Even no matter how long you've been in a job, it changes, and this is one of the fastest changing paces industries there is. You really need to keep on top of that, because it can just be that one minute you're having an argument saying it'll never happen, and the next minute it's on your computer, it's on your office every single day you're dealing with it.
But here's another good example. So we have a web filtering solution, and we can say we're going to block adult sites,
right,
for example, in the company. 90% of the sites that AI categorizes as adult are accurately adult. If I compare that to a human, the number somewhere, it depends on the human, but it's somewhere in the region of, and we have a team of people that does this, 99.567, depends on the person. So can we use AI to replace a human? The answer is no. We can't use AI to replace a human because it's 90% versus 99%. But the humans make mistakes too. So I can now cross-reference a human's decision with an AI's decision and create better product. And that's one of the other things I would ask companies to look at, is don't go out and say, I want AI to save us money. Go out and say, I want AI to deliver better product, better services to my customer.
So when we're dealing with stuff in layer 8, which is about human judgments, and we bring machines in to surrogates, substitutes for human judgments, what then happens is the bad guys, now they're going to hack those bots. And you're almost in a worse situation then, because now you've invested your trust in that technology, that bot, that AI, as adjudicator, when it betrays or tricks you because it's been manipulated. So there's this really interesting kind of trade-off going on there between the value that you get from introducing the technology and you're actually upping the risk if you're not careful. Can you speak to that? Does that make sense?
I think, first of all, machines cannot determine intent. So that's period. Like you cannot, a machine does not know the intent of a human, and a human doesn't necessarily always know the intent of a human.
Absolutely.
I think we have to be super careful about handing decisions over. And you know, we make an internal joke that an AI developer is like a really fast bad developer. So if we have a bad developer, we can ask them to do something and it will spit something out bad 2 weeks later. If we have an AI developer, we can ask it to do it and spit something out bad. I think we have to be super careful about how we implement it. I think we cannot use it to determine intent. We can use it to very, very quickly, faster than humans can, determine what something's doing. And when we think about a security point of view, we shouldn't 100% trust its decision, but it allows us to isolate where we should focus our immediate attention. So I don't like the idea of security through responding to anomalies on your network, because it's the worst way you can secure your environment. You should always start with, I'm going to block first, I'm going to shut down ports, I'm going to limit access where access is required. But at some point, we have a response. So from a security world point of view, you've got 15 alerts with 15 scripts that ran in your network, per se. And you're busy as a SOC manager. You can ask AI to tell you, what does it do? Now, should you 100% trust that answer? Absolutely not. But if AI spits out that this one's doing something, extracting your files, for example, not is it good or bad, but what's it doing? And it says the next one is just running a software update. You're going to pay more attention to the other one faster. So it allows us to divert our attention very quickly, but we shouldn't be trusting it. And yes, it can be manipulated and it can be tricked into saying things that it shouldn't do. And also, it's very, very confidently wrong.
Yeah.
When it's wrong, it will just confidently give you the wrong answer. Whereas a person sometimes, because I've seen people confidently wrong as well, will say, I don't know. And I would rather it say, I don't know.
Mm. The language it uses, it's so strident and so confident. And I think what we haven't done as humans yet is learn how to parse that and sort of hear when things are stated in the way they are by large language models, that there's this sort of implicit quotes around the whole thing. Yeah.
The moment we take an AI decision on something and assume it's good, then we're failing. And I think if as a technology company, we focus on how do we make our product better, not saving 5% off our bottom line, we'll be able to build more than 5% more. So that's kind of how we'd see it. And we should use AI to improve our technology and to validate, but not necessarily to make primary decisions. And I think as a business, you've got to be super careful about, is it taking my data and learning from that data and potentially putting out there, especially if you have intellectual property.
That's a debate we've all had, I think, at some point in the last few years, where you're like, no, I don't think that you should upload that entire database to a large language model that's public. That's no, definitely not okay. So what's in store for the next 3 years when it comes to the impact of AI on security?
We've seen new malware generated by AI. We've seen attackers using tools to generate malware to be faster at responding. I think what we did, we exploded a rocket. And right now, it's like when they released Windows 8. It's a whole mess, and then we're going to see a slightly refined version of it that's a little bit better and more stable in over the next 3 years. And I think that's pretty much what we see. And when it comes to security, I think we've already seen the impact. We've already seen well-written scam emails. We've already seen AI-generated malware. I don't think we're going to see much more than that. I think we'll start seeing some data leakage where people have uploaded stuff that they shouldn't have done, or suddenly you can go in and you can say, how do I build plans for an airplane? And suddenly it comes out very much like Airbuses or Boeings, because someone in those companies decided to upload their database. But I'm not massively afraid of it, and I don't think it's going to help us the way the world did, because essentially it's a glorified spell checker and code writer.
It's not going to shape everything. It'll be a tool that we use like a smartphone to some extent, I guess.
We've already seen a big impact, and that's going to, we're going to continue to see that from us, the hackers doing the bad things with it. And we've seen a small impact of it being used to help improve our jobs. I think where we're going to see, I don't think we're going to see a massive change in 3 years, just refined. And that's typically what we see with technology. Suddenly this wonderful thing comes out. When Tesla released the self-driving car, we're thinking in 3 years' time, this thing's going to be able to do everything. And it's getting better. It's always better, but it's not, it doesn't explode as quick as the initial launch.
Yeah. We don't have, you know, autonomous self-driven cars all over the motorways and highways, and like they predicted. We just don't. Maybe. No,
it definitely improves. But that's the same. My feeling is on Crystal Ball, 3 years' time, AI is going to be a little bit more polished than it is now. And a few more people will be using it, but the world's not going to massively change.
We're kind of all caught up in the hype and doom cycle and fearing huge scale and Lilliputian hordes of AIs taking down the world. It's nice to hear something a bit more sobering. Lovely, Danny.
So Andy and I are kind of system analysts and theorists. So we're interested in how different models or perceptions of security work at different levels or for different functions. So how do positive security tools help out in the human layer of security to help staff make the right decisions?
Okay, I'm going to really simplify security into a triangle. There's three ways you can stop any cyber attack, but most cyber attacks. The first one is, and I'll use two examples. You get a phishing email tomorrow, and you get a link saying, hey, you need to log into your Office account to upgrade your credentials. And the second one is you get an email with a piece of malware. So two entry points of attack. There's three ways you can stop that attack. The first one is don't click on the link. It's simple. Don't download the malware. Don't click on the attack. And we have gone through an evolution of trying to train people to be different. And I'll go into why that's not possible in a moment, because I've got a good story on that. The second way is you can detect something bad. So when you click on that link or when you download that piece of malware, it is a known piece of malware and therefore it's detected and blocked, or that is a known bad phishing site and it's detected or blocked. So that's the second way you can stop that threat. The third step is you can put a control in place. Now, both of those have two very different controls. The first one, which is phishing, how can I stop someone clicking on a link and giving their Office 365 password? I can't control the user. I can't control if it's going to be detected. But what I can do is ensure that there's dual factor authentication at the other end of that. So when they steal their password, it's effectively useless. And what I can do is make sure that any software that isn't permitted by the business isn't allowed to run by the business, even if it's a piece of malware. So I think when we think about layer 8, technology is what stops us, our users, becoming vulnerabilities and controls in technology particularly. And I said I'd get back to the why you can't fix the person. I got really mad with someone once and I was like, why would you click enable macros? Did you not see the security warning? And in my mind, it's like, I was younger and more naive at the time. And I said, are you stupid? Like, what is wrong? Why would you not read the warning and see it? And then they pointed something out to me. They downloaded a file from the internet and they said, this gives me a warning, but I'm supposed to do this because that's what I do every day to read resumes. When I open the file, it gives me another warning. When I do this, it gives me another. Why can I click on yes to that warning and not to the next warning? And for me as an IT guy, really, really simple, but as a user who's been pumping data into QuickBooks or some financial system for 5 years, they cannot comprehend the difference between a macro and, hey, this file was downloaded from the internet. Are you sure you want to run it? Yeah, it's a Word document. I'm just trying to open someone's resume. And that is the problem with training. It helps, but it's not what people think it is. And quite often it drives people into fears where they do so much training, they don't know what to click on and what not to click on anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. We strongly agree with this, and we've looked at training and we've looked at all of the kind of dirty underbelly of that, where, you know, your own IT team are trying to catch you out with, you know, phishing exercises. And it comes back to a question I kind of skipped earlier because I thought it was a bit of a psychological hot potato. And it's about the idea of compelling trust and how you can't do that. You simply can't compel trust. But what you can do, which is very corrosive, is to put someone into a working environment, exactly as you say, where, you know, it's their job to do these things that you're constantly advising them not to do. So they're like in the kind of HAL 9000 situation there, because they've got conflicting orders and something's going to have to give.
I think that the answer is put controls in. Make it so, you know, they can't cut themselves. There's a cover on the knife, and they can't, and they can still continue to do their job, and then the users won't be so scared. And where we should focus on training is actually the common things that we want people to know. Like, everyone who starts at ThreatLocker gets a text message from someone. We don't send it, by the way. Someone on their personal phone saying, "Hey, this is Danny. Can you text me when you're in the office?" And that's a very common attack method. So we can just say, okay, this is happening. This is most relevant and topical. People are more likely, if you give someone three things to do, they'll probably do it. If you give them 300, they may do none of them.
Six plus or minus two, so Miller's magic number. Yeah. So as soon as that sixth one comes in, something drops off the bottom of the stack. Yeah,
and actually, we do that. We even know that with IT people, because we do that with our report. We do, I think we do six or eight on our IT report. We used to give people a list of software. So when you deploy ThreatLocker, you're going to get a list of the 500 applications you've run. We're going to show you every app, what it has access to. This has access to your passwords in browser, and it's made in China. It's a coupon clipper. This is able to encrypt files. This was made in Russia. We used to show them the whole list. And we still show them the whole list, by the way. But at the very top of the list, it's got, I think it's six applications. Here's six applications you should prioritize that you should look at. So we're going to take your worst six applications and give them to you. Mm-hmm. And tell you to prioritize them, because it might be eight. I have to look at the report. But we found that when we gave the 500, no one even looked at the report.
And so we also discussed the insider threat quite a bit on the show. And we understand how training awareness, what we were just speaking about, it can help. But we also notice that a happy and cooperative workplace filled with people on the same mission with high levels of internal trust and loyalty is more ideal. But the traitors, defectors, people who are angry with their company may become so with good reason, or because they're set off on a different path or ambition, or because they were turned all along and shouldn't have been trusted. But we would like to say that we've now met ThreatLocker staff both in Europe and in the US, and that's just random events. Like, we go to events and we just find them. They're always fantastic because they're happy. And it's one of the things that we say very often is that if staff are happy and they feel they're in a cooperative environment, they're less likely to become an insider threat. So what's your secret? How's everyone at ThreatLocker just absolutely loving their jobs?
So not everybody is loving their jobs.
Well, the ones who met certainly were.
Yeah, I can promise you. So look, I try and do a couple of things. One is, I think everyone needs to be fighting for the mission that we have. And if you don't believe in ThreatLocker, what ThreatLocker does, we try and remove you from the company. We try and or change your opinion. And we also try not hire you to begin with. You have to believe in what we do. If you don't believe in what you do, you shouldn't be here. So I think that helps. People should believe in your mission, your company, what you're trying to achieve. And it works. And I think there's two types of people that start ThreatLocker. There's people who really, really love what we do, and there's people who really don't like us at all. And we try and get rid of them, like, really fast. We try and move them on because they're toxic. They bring down the environment. And you're never going to have a 100% success rate at that.
So we wonder, you know, what advice you give to companies out there, maybe startups, maybe even mature companies that are transitioning into sort of cybersecurity, how to treat their staff well, attract and retain talent, and how to build a good company.
You have to care about what you're doing and why you're doing it above money, above anything else. And if you don't care about it that much, then you will not survive. It's one of the most stressful things in the world. You give up your entire life. It's not a work-life balance situation. It becomes an entire integration into your entire life, your children, everything. So I think if you're going to start a company and you're not in that mindset, don't do it, because you will not succeed. Because the moment it becomes work and the moment it becomes not your entire life, it's going to fail. I think building talent out, it's hard, first of all. It's really, really hard, and it's getting harder. The economy is in a great state, despite craziness on Wall Street. It's in a really good state, which means there's lots of jobs out there right now, which means anyone you're hiring is quite often at the, you're scraping the bottom of the barrel. I think the big things that I learn is you will not find rock stars. It's unlikely you'll find an experienced rock star. Your rock stars are going to be the people you train, the people you bring up, the people who learn your way of doing things. So if I look at, I've got 180 salespeople somewhere around that area. If I look at my top five, zero of them were salespeople before. Now we hire existing salespeople, zero. Like none of them have any sales experience. And that's just one part of the business. And I think that's the same in everything. So try and build a team of really, really smart people. But don't necessarily look for experience everywhere. You need experience in some places, but you don't necessarily need experience everywhere. So I think where we've got done really well is hiring juniors, giving lots of opportunity, but being completely honest with what we expect from them. Because at the very least, if you started this job and you say, I didn't know it was going to be this hard. It's like, well, we told you, like, don't do it if you don't want to do it. So I think being honest, finding just smart people in general and being as close to them as possible. I have a really nice office here and I spend less than an hour a day in it. And I think that's my app is this hour. So I try and be on the floor. I help with support issues. I solve customer issues. I'll sit down and write code. I'll sit on the marketing floor. And it shows people you're willing to get in the trenches as well.
Create the minds that you want rather than go out looking for them.
Some of the masterminds that we've come across as well haven't had experience. You know, they've come into it, well, they've got experience just like you did, where they've done ethical hacking, or they're really good with computers, or they've even worked with computers, been thrown in at the deep end, but they're not got that 5 years on their CV, and they're often overlooked a lot of the time. They find it harder to get in, and they're some of the best staff out there.
Smart and hardworking people are always going to be, you know, I ask for three things from our staff: skills, hardworking, and really care about our mission. And if we always say we'll accept two. Once you get down to one, like, so, and so we've got salespeople that aren't the best salespeople, but they really care about what we sell. They really care. So they're delivering enough value to the business. Mm-hmm. And that we've got salespeople who are complete rock stars, but if they don't care and they're not willing to work hard, I'd rather not be here. And they're the same on technical people.
And thank you for joining us on the Cyber Show, Danny Jenkins. It's been an absolute pleasure to get to know the co-founder behind ThreatLocker.
Thank you, Helen. Thank you, Andy.
Thanks very much for joining us, Danny.